Now, it's the Thanksgiving weekend in America, which is traditionally a time when political hostilities come to a brief halt. But there are no ceasefires in US politics anymore, and the week of Thanksgiving also witnessed more gun violence, an attack on two members of the National Guard stationed in Washington, D.C., one of whom has now died. The attack was allegedly carried out by an Afghan refugee who President Donald Trump said had been flown in by the Biden administration, as he put it, during the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Trump administration has labeled this a terror attack, and it's permanently paused immigration from what it called all third world countries. Let's talk to one of the most influential chroniclers of the American political scene, not just about the attack in Washington, but the Trump presidency more broadly. He's David Frum of The Atlantic. David, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you.
David, we were talking there about the shooting this week. It's cast a very dark shadow over what's traditionally the launch of the festive holiday season in the States. I wonder what the reaction to this shooting tells us about this particular historical moment in Washington and America as a whole.
Well, I think it casts a false impression about both what Washington, D.C. is like and about what the National Guard presence in Washington, D.C. is like. There is no question there is a lot of crime in D.C., car windows getting broken into, there is a drug market. But the idea that there are random shootings on the street all the time, that's kind of a false impression. And I don't think if anyone's considering a visit to Washington, D.C., I don't think you should be frightened away by the thought that there are people firing off weapons at every corner, especially in the center of town.
Yeah, the presence of this National Guard on the streets of Washington is so highly contentious. I mean, critics of the president have seen these boots on the ground in places like the National Mall, where the Lincoln Memorial is and the Washington Memorial is, as a sign of Donald Trump's authoritarianism. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, well, look, D.C. has a special relationship to the federal government, and we are very used to seeing the National Guard here every 4 years for presidential inaugurations, for many special events. And they're normally a quite welcome presence because everyone understands they have a job to do. These are citizen soldiers. Many of them are first responders in their home states. What is so outrageous about what Donald Trump has done is, for no very valid reason, he's taken the police departments, the fire departments, the EMT departments of many states where people try to serve their country and make some extra money for themselves by giving a weekend a month of national service to the Army. Usually, sometimes they have served previously as full-time soldiers. And he's pulled them to D.C. and to other places as well for no good reason. And what we're really worried about, less more in the states than in D.C., is this is a trial run for trying to manipulate or control who stands in voting lines in November of 2026.
Let's talk about this attack on the National Guard. Let's talk about the political implications of it and the political response. I mean, Donald Trump has instituted this ban on what he calls immigrants coming in from third world countries. What do you make of that?
Well, you shouldn't say institute when he's just posted something on social media. So a lot of the times that Trump pushes the limits of executive power. Now, the president's power over immigration used to be plenary, that is absolute. But in his first term, when he began experimenting with ideas of like banning people because of a religious test, the courts had to find some way to say, you know what, although we used to think your power over immigration was absolute or nearly so, this is so extreme. I mean, having a religious test for immigration that we have to find some way to basically constrain your power. And I think he says these things. I don't know. I mean, as I said, the power is pretty absolute. But if you actually say to the court, I've got a list of countries whom I regard as part of the third world, and they're not going to be able to send people here, what does that mean? That if an American marries a citizen of one of the prohibited countries, that person can't come to the United States to be with their spouse?
I remember covering the 2016 campaign, and when Donald Trump announced that he was going to bring in a ban on Muslims as coming into people from Muslim countries. I remember how jaw-dropping that was. I mean, literally people wondered whether that was for real. People thought it might be fake. It wasn't a real directive coming out of his campaign. But now when these things happen, they have been normalized. That there is just not the shock that there was. And I wonder to what extent has Donald Trump just completely changed the debate in America about immigration? Because as we both know, I mean, one of the reasons he did get elected was this crackdown on immigration. He promised mass deportations, and he is delivering on mass deportations. He promised to strengthen the border, and the Trump administration would say, we are strengthening the border. And that is a popular stance in America right now.
Well, the Biden administration really did lose control of the immigration situation. That's one of the things that helped to bring about their defeat. Maybe to take a step back here to clarify this for people who don't follow these American policies so closely. So there are three main streams of immigration that come to the United States. First, there's the stream of legal immigration, about 1+ million people a year. Those are typically relatives of people already here or people who have married people who are already here. Very little of that is responsive to the economic needs of the country. And a lot of it is driven by family reunification. And if that sort of happened by accident, as it did in many developed countries, so you've got this 1.1 million group that doesn't serve the needs of the economy all that well, that are here for family reasons. Then you have what you might call classic illegal immigration. Young men, primarily, come from the Western Hemisphere, typically, and who cross the border and seek to elude contact with the authorities and to work undetected and off the books. And at the peak in the 1990s and the early 2000s, that was maybe another million people a year. They didn't all stay, but they were coming in, and their job was to not come into contact with the law. What happened during the Biden years, and this has happened in other developed countries as well, was through a combination of push factors from poorer countries and then a breakdown of law and order and authority here, the asylum system got converted into this kind of semi-legal system. Where you have, of course, in every country, you have a right to apply for asylum, but it's no guarantee that you're supposed to be in. And in fact, the vast majority of asylum applications in the United States are rejected. But if you have hundreds of thousands of asylum applications, the system is not equipped to deal with that many in a year. And so the backlog pens up, and the people are released into the country pending an asylum hearing 5 years, 7 years, 8 years, and ultimately a decade later. And so they're not breaking the law because it's not illegal, but of course it's completely outside the law and it's not the way the law was intended. And Biden lost control of that. And millions of people arrived without anybody intending it before Biden in his very final months got serious about doing something about that problem. And that was a situation that brought Trump in. And I wrote a lot about that for The Atlantic. It was my first article for The Atlantic at the beginning of the Biden administration, saying if Biden opens the sluices on asylum, it will break his administration. And it was one of the last things I wrote. And that's indeed the problem. And something had to be done about that. But what Trump has done is this performative brutality and the use of federal resources as policing within the states against the opposition and objection of state governments. And that's created a rule of law crisis.
You're listening to ABC Radio National. This is Saturday Extra with me, Nick Bryant, and I'm talking with David Frum of The Atlantic magazine, one of the foremost chroniclers of the Trump years. David, Donald Trump hasn't had a good month. The Democrats did very well in the gubernatorial elections in New Jersey and Virginia. Those are the governor's races there over the release of the Epstein files. We saw a full-blown MAGA revolt. He's split with one of MAGA's most fervent loyalists, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. His approval ratings are shaky. Some senior Republicans are questioning the approach to the Ukraine peace plan, which is very Kremlin-friendly. Is Donald Trump showing signs of political weakness?
Well, his biggest problem are the tariffs and the economic costs he imposed on the country. Americans remember at least the first 3 years of the first Trump term as a relatively prosperous time. And he got away with a lot of bad actions because people felt prosperous. And in prosperous times, people don't always care a lot about corruption at the top of the government. Trump inherited a situation where inflation, which had burned hot in 22 was and 23, was subsiding in 2024. And he imposed these massive price increases on just about everybody and did it completely unnecessarily, maybe illegally. The courts will rule on that. But everything just feels more expensive. And you just notice this every time you go to the store, every time you buy furniture, every time you look at a new car, everything costs suddenly more. And unlike the Biden inflation, which was the aftermath of COVID and no one wanted it, this was done intentionally and deliberately and despite warnings that the tariffs were going to do this. And That's his core political problem, is the economy is really bad and job creation is really bad and getting worse.
One of the things that struck me, David, about covering the Trump administration in the first time round was that how many people who were Trump supporters were prepared to vote against their own economic self-interest. They could see that the tariffs brought in the first administration were hurting them economically, but they tended to look at it sort of more culturally, which was, at least he is standing up for us. At least he is fighting China. At least he hears us when we talk about the cost of living crisis. Has that kind of compact with his own supporters started to fray and break down?
Yeah. Well, people always vote in every country for a mix of economic and cultural reasons. And you can also argue about what is a cultural, is crime a cultural issue? It certainly affects the economy. But in those first 3 years of the first term, things were generally prosperous. The job growth was strong. Wages rose faster than prices. Now, it all came to grief in 2020. But for 3 years, people felt reasonably good. And so it was a cheap thing to say. This time, the economic situation is really frightening. Young people have trouble getting work. There's very little net job creation. Prices are running faster than wages. And there's not a lot of optimism that any of this is going to get better soon. Trump's only hope is that the Supreme Court takes away the tariff tool from him whenever they decide the tariff validity case. But who knows whether they will do that, and who knows when that will happen.
I'm glad you brought up the courts, because one thing we did see this week is pushback from the federal courts. A judge throwing out the case mounted against one of Donald Trump's political enemies, James Comey. He was the former director of the FBI. It was part of what's called the so-called vendetta agenda. Congress seems to be reasserting itself a little bit more. The courts seem to be stepping in a little bit more. Are we seeing, David, from the checks and balances of the American system kicking in?
The most important check and balance in the Trump years has been the federal system, the power of the states. Congress has not defended its prerogatives, and the courts have struck against Trump, most when he violates technicalities. I mean, the case against James Comey and Letitia James, the former FBI director, the former New York State Attorney General whom Trump brought, there was a problem that he appointed an invalid prosecutor. There are rules, prosecutors have to be confirmed by the Senate. Trump bypassed that in a way that fell afoul of technical rules of how you bypass it. And he then burned up his statute of limitations time, and he had only the one signature of the invalid prosecutor on the indictments, and so everything has just fallen apart. So the courts will enforce technical rules. They will not enforce broader rules. We have a report today that Secretary of Defense wants to call himself Secretary of War, but that's not legal either. The title was given by Congress in 1949. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth gave orders to kill people who tried to surrender when their boats were sunk on the high seas. Now, if you accept that these people are combatants, that's a war crime. If you don't accept they're combatants, it's just plain murder. It's certainly illegal, but the courts will be very careful about intervening in that, and it'll be up to Congress, and we'll see whether they choose to do anything. But at least two people, and maybe more, were killed while trying to surrender to American law enforcement.
David Frum, you are one of the deep thinkers about America. You have a great sense of U.S. history. It may be premature to ask this question, but I wonder to what extent has Donald Trump already changed America, not just in this moment, but looking ahead?
You can see the changes, and some of them are petty. He admitted a social media post the other day, in which he used unbelievable language, demeaning and dismissive about the governor of Minnesota. He calls women names all the time. Now, maybe the next president won't do that, but as the comedian Sean Gillis has a funny bit about it, that Trump has just shown politicians you can talk in ways that people didn't think politicians could talk. He's also demonstrated you can get away with levels of corruption in the American government that no one imagined you could get away with. In his first term, he directed millions of public money to his pocket. In this term, he and his family have made $1 billion out of their meme coins, much of it from foreign sources. And the American system just seems powerless to say the president of the United States should not be taking gratuities from foreign persons, foreign companies, and foreign countries.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary period to be watching the White House. It's an extraordinary period to be in Washington. David Frum of The Atlantic, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Bye-bye.
Getting in touch with ABC RN is easy. Join the conversation live using the ABC Listen app's call and text features.